I stood on the edge, ropes and harness, full climbing gear, ready for the descent. In front of me, below me, sprawling darkness, wind, and an 80-meter climb down sheer rock. Behind me, the forest, loud and familiar and alive. Standing on the border of light and dark, it wasn't just the void that scared me. It wasn't just the descent that made my stomach pull and my breath short. It was the unknown. Why do we do it? Why do we leave our place of comfort and step out? And when we do, what do we hope to find? I flexed my hands, tugged at my harness one last time, and started down into the abyss. Today, stories about the world beneath the surface, places on Earth we're still discovering, and how we change when we leave the familiar behind.
Welcome to Expedition Earth, a podcast where we reconnect to the wonders of our world and find a way to protect them. I'm your host, National Geographic Explorer Lily Sedigat. Together, we'll rediscover what makes us human.
In the early 1990s, a local man named Ho Khan was walking through the forests of central Vietnam. He was searching for agarwood, a valuable timber, when he stumbled across something big. A massive opening in the ground, dark, with sounds of rushing water and wind blowing through it. Without any sort of gear, investigating the opening was impossible. Years later, a group of cave researchers were in the area. They were interested in Ho Khan's discovery, but years of rain, floods, growing jungle, and falling trees had changed the area. The researchers left, and in a final effort to go where he'd forgotten, Ho Khan returned to the jungle and once again found the entrance to Sun Dong, the largest cave in the world.
My name is Martin Estrom. I am a Swedish photographer from the start, but now I'm definitely also kind of a visual storyteller because I explore a lot of new formats.
Martin specializes in what are known as immersive experiences.
I've done several stories in virtual reality and 360 video, and also using these new formats like 3D and augmented reality to somehow go beyond images and videos to make something that allows you to step into the story.
With technology, Martin is able to build a world of sights and sounds, to bring people into a place and a moment they couldn't normally go. His stories allow anyone to come face to face with a pride of lions in Zambia, into the lives of people along the Ganges River, and deep underground to explore the wonder of Sun Dong. But he started with photography.
Yeah, it started way back in the beginning of my career. At that time, I was more of a breaking news type photographer, at least working with very time sensitive stories. But I grew tired of the dynamic of that part of the media.
Martin was covering the refugee crisis.
This was at the time when the Syrian war had just started in Syria. So a lot of refugees were spilling into Jordan and Lebanon and these other countries and also coming to Europe.
He found himself creating stories and photographs that might have been accurate, but didn't fully communicate what he'd felt on the ground.
And we came back with these stories that had deeply touched me. I came back on a flight crying from all the people in desperate situations that I had met on the border from a war. And I came back and, you know, had so much feelings built up because I had met those people, and tried to convert their stories into images and words is incredibly hard. And even though we did our absolute best, sometimes it felt like it published and literally no one cared. I couldn't conjure the same feelings in them that I had had because I had had the experience. I had been there. I'd seen them. I'd met those people. So that's where it started for me. And my first dive into interactive storytelling was just that, making a virtual reality story from a refugee camp.
In the story, you start on the rooftop of a caravan. Tents with faded UNHCR logos and short rectangular boxes that look similar to shipping containers stretch through the rock and the desert all the way to the horizon. You're able to turn 360 degrees, and when you do, Satari, the camp, unfolds in every direction. The experience allows you to explore freely, visit the head office, a bakery, a tent selling wilting vegetables and a few boxes of food. You can hear the stories of families, a poem written by a former Syrian fighter pilot. And as you go through, you get a sense of the scale of the camp. What life must be like for the 100,000 people who fled the conflict in Syria and had to find some place to live in the Jordanian desert.
The main feedback I've had is like people take off the headset or they stop the experience if they've experienced it on a screen. So they come out of the experience and say, oh, wow, I had no idea it was like that. Like I had no idea a refugee camp was that big. I've seen the pictures. I've seen all the stories. I had no idea. So, you know, it's like these immersive formats, they somehow tap into a spatial feeling and understanding of actually being there that I can't do in photos. So I had an editor tell me, for instance, on the refugee story that I've edited probably 200 stories from refugee camps and 200 stories about the Syrian war. But this is the first time I fully understand what the refugee camp feels like.
Martin found with the immersive format, he was able to build an emotional resonance, much closer to what he actually felt himself.
So people come out of these experiences and just say they felt it. And definitely in some of these stories, people have come out even crying, especially from the refugee stories that really, really do touch you. And I've never had someone cry in front of my still photographs, but I've had people cry when they come out of these immersive stories.
A key part of Martin's life as a storyteller has been connection with places and people whose presence we can feel, but who perhaps we've never actually met.
My grandfather died just before I was born, so I never met him, but he was always present anyhow.
Martin's grandfather was a journalist.
He did this journey when he was a kid growing up in very rural part of Sweden, but he decided to uproot himself and move to Stockholm and become a writer and reporter.
Even after he'd passed away, his presence was still clear in the family. His camera still sat on the shelves at home. And when Martin became a teenager, he began making photographs with his grandfather's cameras.
They were obviously film analog cameras that I don't use the very cameras anymore, but one of his lenses I still use like almost every week. So this is this old Nikon lens from 1970 or something. There's something about it that you can't reproduce in one of these modern camera lenses. It feels like a profound thing to be able to look down the barrel of the same lens that my grandfather used for a lot of his photography.
Martin's father worked in aviation, and his job allowed the family to travel. While his classmates were in the mountains or skiing during school breaks, Martin and his family were somewhere in the U.S., the Pacific, or Southeast Asia.
And on one of these trips when I was probably like 12 or something, and I had just been allowed to use my grandfather's camera, loaded it up with film, and I had, I think, one or two rolls, so 36 or 72 images on the whole trip with our family. And we were going on this, I think we were going on a boat along the Khao Phraya River.
The family was traveling through Thailand when Martin noticed a girl sitting a few rows down on the boat, and a sudden thought came to him.
I took up the camera and I realized I was nervous. I was a 12-year-old with my camera, like, oh, can I photograph someone I don't know? Let's just try. And I held up the camera, I looked down the lens, and she looked back, and I snapped a photo, and I was hoping that it was a good one. Obviously, I couldn't see directly. It was an analog camera, so I had to go back to Sweden. So it was weeks before I even saw the photo developed. But I knew that I probably had got the exposure right. I think I got the focus right. And it turned out I did. I had a decent portrait of that girl that I had met.
It was the first time Martin connected with someone through a photograph.
It was that magical point where I realized that I can actually meet someone through the camera. And she, in that photograph, she even wanted to be part of it because she looked into the camera. Even if that was some sort of silent approval of being part of my picture. And that thing has obviously just become a big part of my career, photographing people, meeting them through a lens and connecting with them. But that was the very first time it happened. It was, I will always remember it as this, yeah, very profound understanding that, okay, this is what photography is all about.
After creating the story about the refugee camp, Martin began to think more about the immersive format. What kind of story is right for this type of medium? He was considering what to do next when he came across Sun Dong.
I had heard and saw a few images. I know that Carsten Peter of National Geographic had been there taking some fantastic photographs. And I was like, this is the perfect thing that I want to cover in an immersive story.
Sun Dong was unknown for most of human history. It wasn't surveyed until 2009. Once an expedition team mapped it out, people quickly realized how massive it was.
And especially since it's a cave, a perfect thing to do a virtual reality story from, because it is this spherical, very spatial experience of space. So I knew, as soon as I heard about the place, I knew that this, I want to capture this, purely from an artistic point of view, really. There was also, like, a few months later, there was news about developments in Vietnam, where a big tourism company, they had suddenly divulged plans that they wanted to make a cable car into the cave. So they were literally news that this big cave, this largest cave on the planet that they had just found like a year or two ago, now someone wanted to make that into not just a tourist attraction, but actually build a big cable car system inside it.
Caves remain some of the places left truly to explore. Many remain unmapped, unfound. Some of the few parts of our planet entirely unknown.
Like, literally, when you look at stuff we can truly explore, because the word explore is easy to throw around, but to fully actually explore something can be hard in some fields on our planet, because we've explored many, 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 many things. There's not much left to explore. The oceans are definitely, there's a lot left in the oceans, but also in caves. Caves are part of the unknowns of our planet. I'd only thought about caving as this hard logistical thing squeezing into tight spaces and seeing spiders everywhere. But when you think of it from an exploration point of view, I love to be a part of that sense of discovery of new places that are underground. Maybe we can find something archaeological in there someone's actually been there in the past. So it might be that someone has used a cave that no one's then been in for 2,000 years. I mean, that happens all the time when people dig in caves. But it also might be that we find something that truly no one has ever set foot in. And that's exciting because it's part of the Earth and our planet that we literally don't understand yet in a full sense.
Sun Dong means mountain river cave. From the outside, it looks like a mountain. The area is limestone. And the entire cave system itself was hollowed out, formed by millions of years by flowing, dripping, cascading water.
So you have a mountain with a river inside it. And what's even more fitting is that you're inside this mountain, and as you go in and go through Sun Dong, there are several places where you have to wade over the river. So you're like inside the cave, and then you come up to this massive river that feels like it should be outside in the jungle. But that's, of course, part of the system that formed the cave. It's ridiculous how big this place is. It has its own ecosystem and its own river system for sure. So Mountain River Cave feels like a fitting name.
Martin received emergency funding to document Sun Dong. With the threat of development looming in the background, he organized a team of over 40 people and headed into the jungle. It was a journey just to reach the entrance of the cave. And when they finally got there, Martin found himself suddenly confronted with the reality of crossing over into the abyss.
I definitely remember a lot of anxiety in me and of our team as we were rappelling down into Sun Dong.
Even just entering the cave meant rappelling down into darkness.
We were in very good hands. We were exploring this place together with the two British cave explorers who found it and an expedition team. But still, as you walk through the jungle, you have the sunlight and the birds and a lot of bugs to accompany you, you know, a lot of fresh air to breathe. And then you clip on to a harness and slowly just see that hole disappear in the distance above you. And it just keeps on going because we were rappelling something like 80 meters down into the first section of the cave. And it's just, it is a daunting experience to let go of the upper world and go down into caves.
While some caving is tight, with low ceilings and long, wet crawls through the dark, Sun Dong turned out to be different.
There's so much space that even though you're in a cave and you feel that you're in the abyss, it's still such a massive hallway that in one sense, it doesn't fit the perfect description of a cave. You know what I mean? You're in a massive space. Though you might have to squeeze through a passage here or there, you're still walking on like the floor of something huge.
Martin was expecting the experience to be cold, uncomfortable, full of bugs. But to their surprise, the cave was 27 or 28 degrees. And aside from getting wet shoes, it was actually somewhat pleasant. As the team continued on, making their way through the darkness, they found themselves in a world unlike anything they'd ever experienced before.
As we came down and started exploring the first section, you always hear the river system kind of pouring because you have to wade over that river at the beginning of that section. You always have the dripping sounds everywhere because you're in this very vast dark chamber. All of these river systems above you and below you are somehow saturating the air and the whole experience with water. But also you have this weird echoes because it was so huge. You didn't have the echo you would expect from a smaller chamber or from being in a very bare room. But you have these, for large sounds and for when a rock would fall, you have these massive echoes in the distance that just put an emphasis on how massive this place was. You were inside a space, a type of audio space I'd never been in before.
The farther they moved into the cave, the clearer it became. This was someplace special.
Sun Dong is this, it literally feels like an alien landscape. I'm still unsure if I will ever set foot in a place that's more magnificent and just feels more alien than Sun Dong. So I can only describe it as this cathedral of nature, really. You can fit Empire State Building in there. A Boeing 747 can fly through some of these chambers, like without hitting something. And when you light it up, you see these absolutely gorgeous cave formations, these stalagmites and stalactites that have formed over hundreds of thousands of years undisturbed. Because remember, no one found this. No human ever set foot here until like 2012.
And while Sun Dong itself is a pristine ecosystem, there's one aspect in particular that makes it unlike any other place.
But I think the most stunning feature, what really sets it apart from most other caves, is that it has two big openings in the ceiling. So in two places, that's called dolines or sinkholes, at some point in time, probably a few hundred thousand years ago, the cave ceiling collapsed. And of course, that lets sunlight in. And that means that part of the seeds and part of the forest really from above just fell down. So now you have two separate pieces of jungle growing several hundred meters underground inside the cave. So as you're walking through the cave, these massive cathedral halls, in one place you're in this dark chamber that you literally need massive lights to light up to see even the cave walls because it's so dark. But then you step out into these dolines or the sinkholes and they're just, you're walking up into a forest. But you still look up and you see that you're deep underground. You start to hear birds. You start to hear monkeys. There were not monkeys living inside the cave. They didn't go that far down, but they were still in the jungle above. So you could see some of them jumping into trees really far up there outside the cave. You have all the birds and they're living on the periphery of this cave environment. The birds definitely came down. So you have all these sounds that somehow feel like the jungle, but it's still very muffled and it's still coupled with this dank, damp environment that kind of puts a lid on everything. So it's this, you can't even take it in. You walk up there, your legs brush through ferns and grass and small trees. In the other section, you even have 30-meter tall trees that you're looking at. So you're walking through a jungle, but then you look up and realize, oh yeah, I'm still deep down inside this cave. So it's just, I can't, yeah, that's why I felt this deserves like an immersive story. It's hard to even describe in words. Seeing these landscapes underneath the earth is like the most profound visual experience I've ever had. And I'm sure might be one of the most profound ones I'll ever have in my whole life.
Time constraints and financial limitations meant that the team only had 5 days to document the entirety of Sun Dong.
Even just a single gigapixel 360 photo here could take upwards to like 2-3 hours to do. So as you can imagine, we needed to have a team to help with all the expedition logistics, because we could not, we literally had to just eat and then run into the cave, start capturing again for like 17 hours, then come back exhausted, eat and sleep again.
Creating an immersive story like the one Martin had in mind presented more technical challenges than creating a single image or video.
The trick with 360 photography, especially back then, now it's a bit evolved, but the simple physics of making 360 photography is that we have to capture all angles. We have to capture something in 360 degrees. We had to take a lot of pictures, like hundreds or thousands of pictures of a single scene, and we don't know until we sit by a computer way later if everything turns out correctly.
With such a tight schedule and everyone already pushed to capacity, the team had no room for any sort of error.
The worst moment, the absolute worst moment, was capturing the first huge 360 panorama inside this Hand of Dog section, one of the biggest chambers. Because me and Eric, we had set up the shot, we knew from experience what type of settings we needed for exposure and so, but still, this place is so huge that when we lit it up, when we told the guys with the lights to light up the other parts of that chamber of the cave, we barely saw the light because it's so huge in here.
They brought some of the strongest portable lights on the planet, capable of powerful illumination as much as some stadium lights. And still, Sun Dong was so massive, the light seemed to have almost no effect.
I could barely see it at the edge of the cave. But I knew from experience that even though I can't see it, it will help the camera. So we simply had to breathe deep and say like, okay, this looks bad. We can't really even see the lights, but we're hoping that the camera captures enough of it. So we did that full shoot. That took like hours. We knew that we can't redo this. If we're going to redo this, we're going to have to cut something else out. But we took a deep breath. We did it. And we were just hoping that this light was enough for the camera, for all this raw data we had captured, that we could actually bring out the colors so we didn't have just a big, super high resolution black 360 degree panorama. That would kind of, that would be our defeat. So we were super anxious, but we couldn't know if we had succeeded until way later that night when we could sit down by our computers in our camp. We did just a super rough preview stitch, as it's called, taking all these photos, compressing them in size so we could do it more quickly. And we tried to stitch together this 360 panorama, and we could see a hint that, yes, it worked.
Martin and the team spent the following days working through 17-hour shifts, rushing to eat meals of canned food, taking turns charging batteries for the lights. Eventually, they were able to create enough material to make an immersive experience of Sun Dong. It wasn't until much later, when they'd returned home and began to piece it all together, that they started to see something quite different than what they'd actually experienced in person.
What I don't think people realize is that we never saw the cave like they can see it in our experience. Because when we were working in the cave, that was a 99% dark experience. So when I came back from Sun Dong, from the expedition, we were all thinking of this place as definitely beautiful. And we had those jungle sections we were all amazed by. But the rest of it was kind of a very dark experience. We had just seen whatever's in front of our headlights. So a few months after, when we were finally stitching this together, then you see this beautiful palette coming together. And I was just amazed at how much color and detail was in these gigapixel images. And that's what you can see in the actual story. Because it's all lit up, You see everything from the stalagmites who go from yellow to green to some of the lichen and some of the other limestone parts that are almost red and these deep purples. You have the green lichen and moss on some of the parts at the bottom, and then it somehow fades into these jungle parts of it. We have never seen that. That's not something we experienced. So in a sense, the immersive story here, what we were able to capture, is a way better experience than the wet, dark, and cold experience of being there.
While Martin and the team were able to document Sundong, the issue of development still remained. Natural resources and beauty provide an opportunity for tourism. But how we monetize this becomes a critical question. How do we create sustainable models for tourism? Can we open an area to tourists and still preserve nature? For Sundong, the debate raged about how to present the cave to the rest of the world. Eventually, a group of young activists called Save Sundong contacted Martin and asked if they could use his story.
So they went all around Vietnam, put this on people's heads so they could step into the cave and used it as one of their big tools to convince people to save this place. And that took on a huge scale. When they did that, they toured the country literally and rallied a ton of support.
The Save Sundong activists received so much support that when former U.S. President Barack Obama traveled to Vietnam to give his last foreign address as president, the group was able to meet with his staff and share Martin's story with them.
I still don't know if Obama got to try it in VR. I pray that he did, but I know that they got their attention big time. When Obama made this last foreign address in Hanoi, he talked about all things in Vietnam and a lot of conservation issues and mentions Sundong by name, saying that it needs to be preserved for our grandchildren. And that's such a fantastic breakthrough. I could never dream of any type of impact like that. And if our VR story played even a small part in that, I'm so incredibly thankful and happy that we were able to do that.
After Sundong, Martin's work took him to Kyrgyzstan to document new cave systems, to search for new discoveries, for something that might uncover a link to our human past, or maybe something entirely new. His journey doesn't always take him hundreds of meters down into darkness, but it has continued to push him into the unknown.
The abyss to me is all this, the stuff that makes us afraid to go in because we simply don't know what's there. And I think that's been a part of many of my projects in a quite physical sense, like with caves, when you're entering something you'd physically don't know what's around the next corner and you're somewhat afraid of it. But it's also in a mental sense, it's the abyss can be to me something of the great unknown of exploring stuff way outside my comfort zone that I have no idea what to expect, and I know that I'm plunging into something where I'm over my head. So we were hyper focused, and I remember sometimes that even becomes a problem because it's hard for me to even take in the place. But there was one moment I definitely remember all of us like really taking it in. So this is like 3 days into the production maybe. We had already been working 17 hours per day, sleeping and doing renders on our computers inside the cave. But then on like the third day or something, we go uphill inside the cave on a very big uphill struggle. And then come into the second sinkhole, which is the largest forest. That's literally when you step out from a dark, cold cave tunnel and into what feels like a forest. We're still underground, but you see 30 meter tall trees, you hear the birds, you hear a monkey up top somewhere, and you see big palm trees growing here at the bottom of the cave floor. So when we came up there, and everyone was exhausted, but we still had energy going, we had a lot of work to do, but we came to this point where everyone just walked up there. We waited for each other. I remember we took our helmets off. We felt like astronauts taking off our helmets because we could breathe the oxygen again. And we stood at this little platform overlooking this forest, which is like a 1 kilometer forest underneath the earth. Everyone took off their helmets and just stared at it in awe. And I remember we probably had a full 15 minutes or 20 minutes there when we actually did not work and we did not think about photography and just like looked at each other, said like, holy, like, how is this even possible? And we were so thankful to be able to see it in real life, to see it for ourselves, to experience it, because it was the most, it was such a crazy experience to stand there and see this, witness this. And we all probably realized that we might not see something as absolutely gorgeous and wondrous, maybe not see anything like that in our lifetime again.
To learn more about caves, check out National Geographic's program, The Explorer, Deepest Cave, where a team of elite cavers attempt a months-long expedition through Cheve Cave in Oaxaca, Mexico, an underground maze of twisting tunnels and dead ends in search of the bottom of the deepest cave on Earth. Expedition Earth is produced by National Geographic Asia, in partnership with the National Geographic Society. I'm your host, Lily Sedigat. Thank you for listening.